call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum, but we're going to go ahead and get started so we stay on time. We're going to continue on with the budget presentations. First on the list, we have AURI, and then we're going to move back into the Department of Agriculture, all right? And we're planning on getting through plant protection, food, feed safety division, laboratory services, agriculture emergency account, and then start the overview with NDA's base budget and the governor's rec. So with that, you've been here before. You know the routine. Senator, please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Dan Scogan, Government Relations Director for the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. Today you'll see the details on our budget, and we're going to start with a real quick overview from our Executive Director, Shannon Schlecht, and then I'll bring in our Operations and Financial Senior Director, Adam Stratton, to present the numbers.
All right. Thank you so much. We do officially have a quorum now, so we'll officially call the meeting to order. Mr. Schlecht, please state your name for the record and begin.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Shannon Schlecht, Executive Director of ARI. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just a brief background on ARI. Our mission is to foster long-term economic benefit for Minnesota through value-added agricultural products. We do this through our facilities and our people that we have on staff at ARI. We have 28 employees, 24 classified as full-time. We operate out of the facilities in Crookston, Waseca, Marshall, and an office here in St. Paul at the U of M. We also have a 9-member board of directors that oversees our work and sets our direction, including 2 members of the legislature, being Representative Deborah Keel and Senator Rich Dreheim. We have over 25 years of experience, and we've had a great long-term partnership with the legislature. Just briefly, in fiscal year 2016 that you'll hear about our budget on, we conducted 216 projects, 135 of those with individual businesses, and 81 initiatives that are around public goods and trying to move ideas forward. Have seen as last week during the hearing, we are requesting some additional funds for our upcoming budgets. That is $690,000 for facility upgrades in Marshall and Waseca, as well as we are including the governor's budget for some funds for covering our cost of operations as we continue to move forward as costs continue to increase. And that is $340,000 for those expenses, as well as $170,000 for information technology upgrades to upgrade our systems as we have our remote offices, and so that we're better able to connect and be more efficient as an organization. That's just a quick overview about ARI. I'd like to turn it over now to Adam Stratton, our Senior Director of Operations and Finance, and he'll go through a little detail, and I believe you have a handout in front of you with our numbers.
Thank you. Mr. Stratton, please state your name for the record and begin.
Adam Stratton, Senior Director of Finance and Operations with the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. All of you should have a handout directly in front of you this morning. This is our fiscal year budget. You will notice that ARI's fiscal year is different from the state fiscal year, which can make reporting a little bit tricky from our end. Our fiscal year is run on the federal fiscal year currently, and we are actually transitioning right now to the state fiscal year. Thus why you have an FY16 budget in front of you. Our FY17 budget is a shortened year of only 9 months. So this gives a better picture of where our revenue is sourced and how we spend those funds. Just briefly going through here, please feel free to interject at any time and ask questions. You will see our source revenue amounts totaling $4,555,000 for fiscal year 2016. Of that, roughly 80% was through state appropriations, or $3.643 million for fiscal year 2016. That is directly appropriated to ARI through the Ag Bill. You will notice additional line items of outside sources, which includes private grants from initiative foundations and also fee for service work that the organization conducts over the course of the year, where we had budgeted $240,000. In addition, you'll see federal grants as well. That line item showing zero, we do try and leverage our state funds as much as possible with applying for federal grants whenever we can. Unfortunately, in fiscal year 2016, we were not successful. Previous years, we have been very successful with the USDA, the Department of Energy, and we've also sent several applications for grants through the EDA. But as many of you are probably aware, sometimes finding those programs that are fit for your organization can be difficult. For fiscal year 17, we were fortunate and did receive a $200,000 grant through the USDA. So we were very excited about that opportunity. The next line item you'll see is collaborations. That is our partnerships with commodity groups across the state of Minnesota. A lot of that money is sourced from the Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council, along with the Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council and other commodity groups such as wheat, dairy, beef, etc. So $410,000 sourced from those areas for a total of $4.293 million from that section. Going further down, you'll notice other revenue and the fund balances. We had budgeted for $47,000 of interest. That is essentially gain recognized on reserves of the organization as well as interest recognized in the organization for the year. And then miscellaneous revenue of $65,000, which is royalties and donations that we're looking to receive throughout the year as well. The next line item of fund balances available, that would be sourced from our reserves, where we had committed those funds for capital improvements and capital equipment for the organization to ensure that our laboratories are up to date with the latest equipment that's needed, along with other types of capital improvements and infrastructure needed for the organization. We list this on our budget as it is a cash-in and cash-out transaction in order to be as transparent as possible for our board and for others as well. Which gives us, again, a total revenue of $4.55 million budgeted for state or for our fiscal year 2016. Moving to the second half of the sheet here, you'll notice project expenditures budgeted at $510,000. That is cash out for partnership on projects with our clients and also public initiative projects, as well as sourcing partnership dollars from other organizations as well. The support and service expense accounts, you'll notice there are actually several more on our P&L that are presented to our board of directors monthly. We tried to condense this as much as possible to keep it as simple as possible. We have our contracted services all the way down to other support and service expenses, totaling $1.285 million in expenses for fiscal year 2016. And then underneath salaries and benefits at 2.759 for fiscal year 2016. $2 million of that allocated to salaries and wages, roughly around $700,000 allocated to employer benefits and fringe such as state health care, dental plans, employer contribution to the Minnesota state retirement accounts, along with employer paid life and employer paid FICA, which brings our total expenses for the year at $4.55 million, effectively having a net income or no gain of $0 on the year. The past several years before fiscal year 2016 budget, we had actually operated in the red for a few years, spending down some of our reserves. Our current reserve balance is right around that one-year range of about $4.5 million currently. And per best practices, we try and keep it right around that range if we can, just due to, obviously, the state being the main source of our revenue and working on a biennial budget cycle. It makes sense that we have at least 12 months.
Thank you. Could you help us understand a little bit better on fees for service or the royalties piece? As far as what we're doing there, if there's additional dollars that could actually be collected in the form of fees for service or the royalties piece.
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. The fee for service portion, we are actually currently working on a funding diversification plan actively with our board of directors, looking at sourcing additional revenue either through retainer work with some larger types of clients and or companies that we provide services to, as well as maybe smaller organizations that quite do not fit our mission as we see appropriate if we have the capacity. That fee-for-service work is included in the outside sources line item you see up here, which is about $100,000 currently of that line item. As well as your question on royalties, our current royalty stream that we have for revenue is through a patent we had in conjunction with the University of Minnesota from the early 2000s with an organization that commercialized a product. We receive anywhere between $30,000 and $40,000 dollars a year in royalties from that patent that we were written in on, and you would see that under the miscellaneous revenue line item. So again, accounts for probably about 70% of that line item. And again, we are actively looking at other ways to leverage our state funds and see if we can, you know, increase our revenue streams from non-state sources.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers, members? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Can you tell me what services you contracted out for? Yeah. You've contracted services under support services and expenses?
We'd like to take that question, I guess. Staten?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representative members. Very good question. Our contracted services a lot of times are types of services that we have to third party out because we may not have the expertise or the in-house expertise to be able to conduct those types of things. That line item is mainly in terms of our support services. So, for instance, we have to contract out our IT. We do not have a full-time IT person on staff. That accounts for roughly about 30% of that budget. Also, in terms of communications, we have a communications director, but the expertise in terms of writing articles for Ag Innovation News and other things that we need to be able to tell our story to our stakeholders and to the state of Minnesota requires a substantial investment as well. So the majority of that, again, is in terms of the $215,000 you see there, IT and communications related.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then down under newsletter printing, postage, and shipping, that's $54,000 is pretty good part of your budget there. What does that all entail? I mean, your newsletters that go out every month, bi-monthly, and who does it go to?
Mr. Staten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representative, members. Yeah, that newsletter is our Ag Innovation News, again, in terms of the printing, the postage, the shipping, the photography that's required for that newsletter, which is sent out on a quarterly basis. We also do a monthly e-newsletter as well.
Representative Green? Okay. All right. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sand, can you explain again the difference between the fund balance available of $150,000 and then you also mentioned your reserves of over $4 million. How do you keep those two separate, and are those two interchangeable?
Mr. Staten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representative members. The fund balance count, the way we look at it, again, is a balance sheet line item of our net assets. So you can look at it as, again, it is our reserves. It is separated, as you can see on the statement here, and I didn't touch on this, but the board committed capital improvements in equipment for the $150,000 would be taken from our reserve account of $4.5 million. And further down underneath the expense portion, you can see the capital expenditures going out for that same $150,000 that we budgeted there.
Jerry Anderson. Right. And Representative Poston, your question was asked.
My question was asked.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just remind me again how many total employees you have and where they're located?
Staten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representative members. We currently have around 28 employees, 24 of them full-time, 4 of them part-time. Quickly off the top of my head, 8 located in the Crookston office, 6 in our Marshall office, 5 in our Waseca location, 1 in our St. Paul location, and the remainder are all considered remote employees.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any, I know you've got different line items here, and maybe in contracted services and other things, do you have consultants that you routinely would work with or be engaged in doing activities with?
Just that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Members. Yes, there are some consultants that we work routinely with, particularly on the communication side as well, in terms of some of the freelance writers that we hire to do some of the articles for Ag Innovation News, amongst other things, in terms of some of that branding and marketing that's required that we don't have the experience to do internally.
Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then another question I have is just regarding the office space or rental space, and if you own any property, and if you're in partnership with universities or colleges, and just to be able to talk about that a little bit, please.
Strat. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Members. We do not currently own any real property. The organization rents all of its office space and laboratory space, typically in partnership with the University of Minnesota and the Southwest Minnesota State University as well, where our Marshall location is, and we rent the laboratory space and the office space from both, and then through the University of Minnesota extension in our Wasika location and the main U of M campus in St. Paul. So the $200,000 you see allocated there for rent is for all of that in total.
Representative Poppy? Vice Chair Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if I miss this one, but the reserve fund of a little over $4 million. Can you give me just like the two sentence version of what that's for?
Mr. Stratton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative, Members. The reserve fund, as such any nonprofit organization has, is kind of your rainy day fund. You hold a reserve fund for those instances where you may not have enough revenue to cover your programs or expenses for the year. Per best practices for most nonprofits, 9 to 12 months is a bare minimum that you'd want to hold in a reserve balance and or your rainy day fund, and that's currently what we have at the moment. Again, I'd mentioned earlier, 80% of our revenue currently comes from the state. That being our main source of revenue, working on a biennial budget cycle, you can see the importance of having some reserve funding available in case that it were to be needed. Best practices also states that you know, you should base your reserves on the budget cycle of your main source of revenue.
Vice Chair Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a request. Can I? It's no rush, but can I get a copy of the balance sheet from Ten
Strat?
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Members, absolutely, I can get that for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is a fiscal analyst question, but I remember a few years ago there was, I think, a tax expenditure or a tax appropriation that went to $1 million a year, and is that a one-time, or has that been rolled into the budget for the agency?
Mr. Sager?
Mr. Chair and members, there was for some time prior to the 2015 session when this budget area, particular ARI's account, did have a statutory appropriation that was in the tax committee's jurisdiction. That appropriation has since ceased, and now it is on the general fund appropriation from the Agriculture Committee, the $3.6 million per year going forward.
Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So essentially, there was no loss in revenue. It changed from the tax jurisdiction to this committee's jurisdiction.
Mr. Sager.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that is correct.
And follow Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and so and maybe I'm not seeing it here, but when I look at the budget sheet, and so we have total revenue, $4.555 million, expenses, $4.55 million, and project expenditures of $510 million. So one way you could look at that, that we've got 89% overhead for projects. Do we have a breakdown of administration versus jobs created for this, or am I looking at that wrong? actual dollars spent on projects.
Who would like to take that? Schleck.
Mr. Chair, representative members of the committee, ARI's role in providing assistance is really through our human resources and our capital that we have in people. We have over 50% of our staff are in the project and technical area, providing that direct assistance to entrepreneurs and to businesses. So when you look at the salary, that is over 50% of that would be for conducting our project and technical work. And then the $510,000 would be the additional expenses and assistance we need where we do not have the expertise in-house to be able to complete those projects and move that process forward. Additionally, any organization needs support services for running projects and programs, roughly 20% of our staff would be dedicated to providing that support to manage those projects and programs as well. So we look at roughly 70% of our budget base would be for programs and services that we provide move those technical ideas forward and to provide that assistance to entrepreneurs and businesses across the state. Roughly 30% as overhead. Representative
Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I know in some of the other things when we've looked at economic development, and you showed estimated jobs created, and maybe looking at that per year, I think we had some analysis when we were looking at IRRB and other ones on how much expenditure, public expenditure is, and what are we getting for it. And I don't know if you have that at your fingertips or if there's something to be provided on that.
Mr. Schleck. Mr. Chair, representative members of the committee. So we have done some collection from our past clients in terms of impact that we've been having as an organization. We looked at a six-year period from 2010, July of 2010 to June of 2016. Roughly the state appropriated us $19 million over that time period to conduct the work for developing food and agricultural innovative products. During that time period, roughly 50% of the projects is what we received a response on. That included over $76 million in annual gross sales in the food and egg space, so a good return there. Nearly $90 million of capital expenditures into the state of Minnesota by businesses attributed to ARI. Over 600 jobs created or retained during that same time period for the investment that the state had made. As well as clients reported that they put forth non-ARI funds of over $30 million against ARI's $18 million to complete those projects and move those ideas forward. So those are some of the return on investment numbers, Mr. Representative, that we have gained, again, representing just 50% of the projects that we completed at that point was the response rate.
Representative Hansen.
All right. Seeing no further questions, thank you for your testimony, and we know how to get a hold of you if we have any additional questions moving forward. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, if we could bring up the Department of Agriculture, Ms. Place. And while she's coming up, we do have some minutes to approve. Representative Eklund, have you had a chance to read the minutes dated January 18th?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair, and I'll move the minutes.
All right. Representative Eklund moves the minutes January 18th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Eklund, have you read the minutes for January 26th? Representative Chair Anderson.
I will approve.
All right, thank you. Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson moves the minutes dated January 26th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Ms. Place, welcome. State your name for the record, and if you'd like to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Whitney Place. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. If I could have staff help me get the display up.
Can we get some assistance there for a PowerPoint presentation?
Great.
There you go.
And first up, we have Gear Frizzo. He is our Director of the Plant Protection Division at the department.
Well, welcome, Mr. Frizzo.
Good morning.
Please state your name for the record and begin.
Yes, I'm Gear Frizzo. I'm Director of the Plant Protection Division, and pleased to be here. So I'll start with, this is sort of our mission statement, is to protect Minnesota agriculture and the environment from plant pests, pathogens, invasives, and noxious weeds. And secondly, to provide certification services to enhance Minnesota agricultural opportunities. So the division is sort of split between two main areas, primarily sort of trying to keep out invasive plant pests. We try to eradicate them when they arrive, and we try to manage them. And then on the second side, we focus on providing certification services for various commodities. So on this first slide, it shows our sort of total budget for the division, and we get the funding from a variety of sources. The general fund supports about, provides about $1.9 million a year. We have a dedicated or fee-based programs which generate about $3.8 million. We do pursue some LCCMR support for various projects, and we're at about $372,000. And then we also pursue federal funding, and we get about $1.5 million in funding from those sources.
And Mr. Friesa, I'd like to point out to the committee, we do have this in color now in your binders so that we can see the charts a little bit better, too. So thank you. Mr. Friesa.
Thank you. I'm going to go through some of our general fund programs first, and then I'll go through some of our dedicated on the second half of my presentation. One of the programs we were very pleased with this past year was our industrial hemp program. We think it was very successful. The hemp program was made possible by the 2014 Farm Bill and also Minnesota Industrial Hemp Development Act that was passed in 2015. So in 2016, we had seven projects. We had about 38 acres planted in six counties. We had three projects that were able to harvest grain with an average yield of about 1,300 pounds per acre, which is used for oil, beer, hemp hearts, and livestock feed. I've heard that the beer is supposed to be good. I have not tried it. We also had harvested fiber at about 1 ton per acre. And I also wanted to mention that last week we had a meeting for interested producers come into the agency. We had over 50 folks attend, so there's a lot of interest in the program. We did have some challenges with DEA. We had to get a permit from DEA. It took almost 6 months, so that created some delays in getting the program going, but a very successful first year. And we also, that program was funded with about $250,000, which is a one-time appropriation in FY17.
This place, Mr. Friesa, I think we're going to take a few questions as we go, if that's okay. All right. Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A lot of interest in this program. I just have to ask, these seven projects and the 38 acres, was the grain that was harvested off those acres and the fiber, were they actually used, or in this small a setting, were they just set aside?
Mr. Friesa. Representative Anderson. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I very much appreciate that question because it reminds me I did bring some actual examples of actual product that was produced. This is actual, it's called hemp hearts, which has been packaged from a farm that was grown from 2016. And this grower has already contracted with a buyer Lee's food store to sell these. And we also have a little picture book from one of our growers who documented. Some of the farms were, these plots were planted too late, so those were not harvested, but we did have some that in the southern counties that were more successful, and they were able to actually get some commercial production off those fields.
Chair Anderson. Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So there were issues with the seed last year with DEA. Do you anticipate that to be smoother this year and get out ahead and get that seed in a more timely fashion?
Mr. Friesa. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, the DEA permit is in place right now so that we don't have to go through that process again. And last year, it didn't come until February, and then, of course, then the growers had to obtain the seed from Canada, so there was a lot of delay. This year, it should go much faster.
Right. Vice Chair Miller.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, are we going to be having a hearing in this, or perhaps, well, it'll probably be in this committee, are we going to have a hearing on this pilot project at some time?
So, We will have, I know this is in the governor's budget request also to extend this, Ms. Place, that's correct. And so we will have some additional information on
this. Just like to know more about this project, but I don't want to do it right now, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The testifier, how many hemp growers do we have in the state?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, last year, as we said, we had just seven pilots, but the meeting we had last week, we had over 50 people show up that were interested. So I'm expecting in the coming growing season that we will have quite a number more. We don't know the exact number yet.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. That's all.
All right. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question about whether or not, what's the status of processing the product for these farmers? Is there an effort to help develop that so that once they have a product to sell to market, it can get processed and move forward?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, yes, on some of the processes rely on sort of existing processes that, you know, already are in place for other crops. There is a need to develop some of the more unique processes. Colorado is probably the furthest ahead, and they have developed a number of processing, but that is an area that will deserve some exploration and work.
Representative Bly. Please continue. And this is what I like about Mr. Friesel whenever he comes, because he always has handouts. Usually it's bugs, but this time it's industrial hemp. So, Mr. Friesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to divert everybody's attention. My next slide is I just want to go through mention we have a noxious and invasive weed program. We basically work with counties and townships. The actual enforcement of the noxious weed program is at the local level by counties and townships. We do provide training for those entities. We work with local governments and landowners. We do have a early detection and rapid response where we deal with emerging weed threats. Examples include oriole and bittersweet or industrial hop. And this is currently we have funding to support two positions, net about $200,000. A weed that's I'm sure gotten a lot of attention more recently has been Palmer amaranth. This is a very aggressive weed. We've been looking for it for the last 2 years. We've surveyed over 700 soybean fields, and these surveys have been supported primarily by federal funds through the Farm Bill. We were able to detect and confirm Palmer amaranth in two counties. These were all limited to what's called conservation reserve acres. There's 13 landowners involved in 30 fields, approximately 275 acres. We are working very hard with the landowners to try and eradicate these sites. We have good response from the landowners. We were able to secure about $50,000 in emergency funding to support these efforts. I know there's been a lot of questions about whether or not our seed law and weed law is sufficient to deal with these. I would comment that we have a very robust seed law and a very robust weed law. In this particular situation, there was some illegal activity that we are still investigating and pursuing.
Thank you. And Mr. Friesel, we do have a question. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you got two full-time staff at $200,000 in general funds. So in a lot of our northern counties, our land commissioners are the noxious weed control person. Is there state funding available to help them with their programs? I'm thinking in Kuching and St. Louis and Lake, we've got the wild parsnip problem, and it's getting worse rather than better.
Ms. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, unfortunately, there is no state funding available to support or assist counties or local units of government.
Mr. Eklund?
Thank you, sir.
Right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To build on that question a little bit, in general, we hear that a lot noxious weed control is a local affair, but it's somewhat haphazard across the state. What's the office doing about kind of coming to a better understanding of that, learning where the gaps are, and making suggestions for filling in those gaps?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do work very closely with each of the counties and with local townships. There are varying levels of, I guess, resources available by the county, and that often influences the degree of attention to noxious weeds. But it is a statewide problem. You know, certain species are more problematic than others in certain areas.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Any thoughts about what causes this uneven distribution of resources applied?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, I think it's primarily a result of resources. It could be, the view of leadership in the county that perhaps they don't value the importance of that some of these weeds pose. But I think I would say primarily it's resource-based.
Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to shift gears on the Palmer Amaranth, what sort of work are you doing to determine needs going forward?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've had quite a number of discussions about those very needs for the department, and I think that is part of the governor's budget is to try and obtain additional resources to address this very situation.
Representative Johnson.
All right.
Jerry Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Friesel, does your department have jurisdiction over noxious weeds in our road ditches?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, there are. The noxious weed designation is sort of a formal legal designation, so it actually specifies specific plants. The actual enforcement is at the county level. The department has additional authority to deal with invasive species in a more general format in our invasive species statutes, 18G. So there's sort of two different statutes that come into play.
Jerry Anderson. Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Well, I saw, maybe because the season was early last year, but I saw a lot of thistles going to seed in our road ditches and things like that. And could you comment on the effectiveness of spraying a weed patch in a field or a ditch as compared to actual cutting them down?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think there are a variety of approaches to weed control. It can either be a chemical by using herbicides, cultural practices, which may be mowing to prevent seed production. We do have a very robust biological control program where we are addressing purple loosestrife, musk thistle, leafy spurge, some of those species. So it's a sort of a multi-tiered approach. And again, it's sort of county-specific as to how they want to approach that.
Chair Anderson. Just a final comment on it. My frustration with the noxious weed laws is that in the counties, when we see a problem and somebody reports it, and then a notice is sent out, and I think the owner has 10 days to respond, by that time the weeds have gone to seed, and the problem has exasperated itself. So I think we need more work in this area, and you had a bill a while back, DNR land, railroad right-of-way, highway ditches. We have, I think, a growing problem with weed control, and now with this MnDOT ruling in August 1st cutting day, I think it's going to get worse, and we need to address that someplace here in the House.
Chair Anderson, I agree. Maybe we should revive that bill. We were billing back the DNR if we had to go in and take care of some of their problems. So, Mr. Friesel. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Palmer Amaranth, Mr. Friesel, you mentioned possible illegal activity. Does the department have the authority to seek restitution for recovering its costs or any harm done to the public?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I would have to investigate that further. I believe the answer probably is likely yes, but I'd have to take a look at 18J. We do have, as I said, it's an open investigation at this point. It's clear that we do have some clear violations that occurred, violations of the seed law, but we have not explored what the final decision is on that enforcement action.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and I think maybe members of the committee know, but if somebody poaches a deer or takes a wild animal, they have to pay restitution. I think a deterrent would be restitution rather than having the public pick up the cost of responding to this and future actions. And so if you don't have the authority, I think we should get it for you for the future, because I think that would be... Otherwise, we're going to be better open up the wallet, because it's going to keep coming and coming and coming in terms of paying for these invasives that are going to be spread by people. Secondly, maybe Mr. Frieser could go back, that we did actually have a county ag inspector program, and we had state oversight of the noxious weed law that was removed at the turn of the century, right? And when was that removed, Mr. Frieser?
Mr. Frieser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, much of the direct regulatory authority that the department itself had was removed, I'm guessing about 8 years ago or so, maybe 10 years. It was during a time when we had a very tight budget situation in the state, and so it was law was amended, basically assign all the regulatory authority to counties and townships.
Representative Hansen.
So, Mr. Chair, so getting rid of regulations at the state level has a consequence, where counties may not have either the willingness or the capacity or the ability to do it. So then if you have a good county who has a strong program for weed control downwind or downstream from a county that either can't or won't have a program, then you get spread of weeds. So pay now or pay later. We're having a consequence of actions that we took during budget cuts.
So, Mr. Friesel, you want to comment, or we have Representative Bly?
Thank you, Chair. And the last two questioners prompted my question, and it has this last summer I had a request from a township supervisors that wanted to know more about the control of wild parsnips, and I asked several agencies to come down to address that issue and talk about it. I'm sure you're familiar with the event, and one of the things that struck me in that meeting was that the control of weeds is very complex, and that although you might think it would be simple just to mow or just to, there are different times when it's more opportune to deal with these things, and also that transportation, for instance, has a different view of when mowing should take place in the ditches that they have, and it becomes a very complex problem to control or issue to take care of at the county level. I think we had county officials there too. They were kind of frustrated by the conversation as well, feeling they didn't have the resources, either the money or the personnel, to deal with some of the issues that were being brought up. But one of the things that came forward was the need for education. And although the state produces good information about weeds and how to control them, and there was also disagreement from the various agencies about what was the best way to deal with wild parsnip. Now, I guess it causes me to ask the question, what would be the best way for us to help you do the job of helping control and develop plans for controlling the various noxious weeds that are out there, and wanting to make sure that counties understood that there is a list that's comprehensive and that needs to be addressed, and should the state have more control?
Mr. Friesen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, yes, dealing with noxious weeds or invasive weeds is indeed complex. You have different types. You have annuals, you have biennials, you have perennials, and approaches vary differently. There's also heightened sensitivity to making sure we protect pollinators along our roadside, so it is complex. We have two very outstanding, excellent weed scientists on our staff, but it's just two people for the entire state, and our entire budget is just $200,000. I think where we can really assist is with additional resources, where we can have more meaningful interaction with the counties and townships and also with the general public in developing some of those best management practices for these specific species as we move along. So,
just wanted to thank you again for the efforts you helped me with to get people to come to that meeting and present. It was really very instructive and very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please, let's continue with your presentation, and we'll take questions at the end.
I just want to briefly talk about our survey work and early detection work for a number of invasive species. We have early detection and monitoring surveys to look for various pest threats to the state. We try and provide education and regulation to mitigate the spread of these pests. These programs are supported with about $1.6 million in general funds, $1.5 million in federal funds, and then we received about $375,000 in LCCMR funds. I do want to point out we have been very aggressive pursuing federal funds, but federal funds pose their own challenges. They are very costly from an administrative standpoint. They tend to restrict us to a specific entity or insect, and they don't allow us to build infrastructure. So we have maybe a two-year grant, so you can't hire somebody permanently with those sort of transitory funds. Put down three examples there. Potato cyst nematode, we do not have that in the state of Minnesota, but it's important that we survey for this because this ensures that Minnesota potatoes are able to be sold to the EU and to Asia and to other countries. Spotted wing Drosophila, this is a new insect that is just starting to take hold in Minnesota. It attacks various berries, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries. And then a new one that is starting to show up is brown marmorated stink bug. And this is also attacks crops, but it will turn into a household invader. And I did bring some examples of the brown marmorated stink bug. And then I just want to mention a couple of forest pests that we regulate. Recently, we had a situation where a homeowner called us and said there's sawdust at the base of my chair, and they wanted to know what it was. So this is the table leg, and I'll pass that around. But you can see the galleries from these insects that are hollowing out the wood. This is furniture that came from China. It has not been heat treated or fumigated in any way. This is a larvae that does not exist in North America but has the potential to infest Minnesota forests. Another insect we are very concerned about is mountain pine beetle. This is a beetle that's been a devastating western forest pest, so we did implement an exterior quarantine for this insect. EAB has, of course, gotten a lot of news. I did bring along some EAB souvenir samples. Please help yourself to take one of these homes if you want to take one for your kids or something. Help yourself. The funding for EAB has really dropped out. At one time, we were getting about $1 million a year from the federal government, and we now receive $0 in funding from APHIS. Gypsy moth is another big one. The department has been involved for over 40 years in trying to delay the introduction of gypsy moth. I'll touch briefly on our wolf and elk depredation programs. We basically provide reimbursement for livestock losses due to wolf and also damage from elk. The current allocation, we receive about $300,000 for FY17, $175,000 for wolf and $125,000 for elk. And then in FY16, we had 137 wolf claims for about $253,000. We had 20 elk claims totaling about $60,000. So the total is 313, and you'll notice that 313 is greater than our appropriation, but that is a result of, in the previous year, we had the number of claims exceeded the dollars that were available, so those were carried over into the next year, and then the legislature did provide an extra $50,000 in funding to cover those claims. So all the claims have been paid in full.
Thank you.
Moving on into our fee-based programs, we are responsible for grain licensing in the states. All Minnesota elevators and warehouses must be licensed, bonded, and inspected. The current bonding is $500,000 for grain storage and $150,000 for grain buyers. We have about 727 grain and general merchandise licenses. And this is a dedicated account that generated about $575,000 in revenue. We also have a wholesale dealer license, and this is, protects growers who sell perishable products, and it requires that wholesale dealers be licensed and bonded. We have about 117 wholesale dealer licenses. And this, again, is a dedicated account that generates about $150,000 in revenue. Moving on, fruit and vegetable inspection. This is very much a fee-for-service program. We inspect over 26 and a half million pounds of fruit, vegetables, and raw nuts. It's based on USDA standards. We also provide audits of good agricultural practices and good handling practices on Minnesota farms. Again, this is fee-supported and generates about $300,000 in revenue. Potato inspections, we inspect and grade fresh and processing potatoes. There's two facilities in Minnesota that we provide this service that generates a little over $700,000 in revenue. We also, Minnesota is one of probably the fifth or sixth largest seed potato grower. We certify Minnesota seed grown. There's just 32 growers. And again, this is a fee supported and generates about $280,000 in revenue. We have a seed inspection program. This also, we inspect seed marketing and distribution facilities. We ensure that seed labels are accurate, correct, and consistent. We verify that the seed is viable and that the purity is correct, and we also verify genetic identity. We monitor the seed supply for the presence of prohibited or restricted noxious weeds. And I'll just mention, for Palmer amaranth, there is a zero tolerance for Palmer amaranth in seed sold in Minnesota. This is a dedicated account and generates about $1.6 million. Nursery inspection, we inspect and certify nursery dealers and growers that sell and export nursery stock. This is intended to prevent the introduction and spread of invasive plants and pests. This is also a dedicated fee and generates about $685,000. We provide all countries that are buying commodities, plant commodities from Minnesota, require what's called a phytosanitary export certificate. We issue between 3,000 to 4,500 of these certificates every year that go to about 110 companies shipping worldwide. Last year, we certified 1.2 billion pounds of corn and 465 million pounds of soybeans. Primarily to Asian countries. We certified 14 billion pounds of corn. Much of this was shipped to the western U.S. Again, this is a fee-based and generates about $320,000. And then my last slide, I just wanted to show, these are sort of the top destinations of where Minnesota commodities go, and you can see China is by far our biggest market for Minnesota. And with that, I'll end, and I think Dr. Ben Miller is up next.
Thank you, Mr. Friso. We do have a question. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the plant protection slide, you have monitor seed supply for presence of prohibited or restricted noxious weeds. Now, what I've been reading, so if you could clarify on the Palmer amaranth, I'm told that that's very difficult to distinguish. That is a specific seed, and you said that we have a zero tolerance for it in Minnesota. Can you kind of clarify for me how you're addressing that zero tolerance?
Mr. Friso.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. It's very difficult. You know, Palmer amaranth is in the genus amaranth, and there's a lot of very common amaranth weeds, red root pigweed, tall water hemp, and so forth. distinguishing the amaranth apart, you need basically for a lab test, you need a genetic test, or what's called PCR. That test has only recently started to be put in place or developed. Previously, the only way you could distinguish it is you had to take the seed, grow it out, and actually get see the plant before you could identify it as being Palmer versus tall water hemp or some other species. Those laboratory techniques are just starting to come online now, and we are starting to do that analysis. We have currently that those tests run about $150 per single seed to conduct.
Vice Chair Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fielso, make sure I say your name right. I'm terrible with that stuff. So do you have a level of confidence that with our seed mixtures that are coming in for set-aside acres, buffers, things of that nature, that do you have a level of confidence that what's coming in and being planted is absent the Palmer amaranth?
Mr. Fielso.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I commented before, I think the regulatory authorities are very strong and sufficient for CRP. The NRCS and FSA already specifies that the seed come from an origin within 200 miles of the planting. We do inspect a seed. We take samples. Because of this situation, we have sent a letter to all seed vendors, putting them on notice that there will be heightened attention to these types of seed mixes. We've also been working very closely with our other state agencies who have plantings, DNR, MnDOT. We've also been working closely with FSA and NRCS. Everybody's very aware of this, and there is you can't say 100% that it won't happen again, but I think all the sort of regulatory barriers, I think, are in place. So,
one more question, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, I'm hung up.
I know,
right? This is why you're our favorite, Mr. Friesa, right here. Vice Chair Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I guess my concern is that $150 a test sample with a very widespread planting that's going to be going on coming up here in the next year or two. So you're confident that with that sheer quantity of seeds that's going to be coming in and being planted, you're confident that we're not going to have a problem with this. Because there's 100% certainty that this is prohibited, you're 100% certain that we can keep that seed out of Minnesota with those tests.
Mr. Friesel.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't say 100% certain, but those tests I will mention are those costs are coming way down. It's very unusual for us to come across amaranth seed anyways. I think we collected 60 seeds, amaranth seeds this past year, and none of those have turned out to be Palmer amaranth so far. I think it's also important to note in this particular case, we're looking at probably 50 seeds total. We believe it's came from a single seed source. Our experience with the vast majority of seed vendors is that they are very reputable. They do not want a black eye for themselves because of this, and I think they will pay much more attention.
Just one more quick thing, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern, and I can't confirm this, so this is more anecdotal, and maybe we can confirm this, but I'm understanding that down in Iowa, I think I heard a statement that about two-thirds of the counties, they believe, have the Palmer amaranth in them, and I'm sure that Iowa has similar programs and stuff like that. So I just think this is something that we need to have very heightened awareness of at this time, and I'm not questioning the veracity of that in your department by any means, but I do think that this is very much a something of concern as we're going into the season this year, that we can have 100% surety that we will not have Palmer amaranth coming over the border from Iowa into Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Friesel. On the gypsy moth eradication in Cook and Lake counties that took place last year. I get to talk about something other than Emerald Ash Borer today anyway. But what's your surety that was successful, or how do you find that out? Because it created, as you recall it, created quite a ruckus in the Ely area.
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're correct. It was a challenging treatment that we did. We used a sort of a naturally occurring bacteria to do the treatments, Bacillus thuringiensis. We had, in those situations where you have a very small pocket of gypsy moth larvae, using that treatment has historically been very successful. I think in Minnesota we're at 100% success rate in those kinds of eradications, as long as we get wide enough. The areas where gypsy moth is starting to become established up in Cook and Lake County, it's so widespread you can't eradicate anymore. And in those situations, we use something called pheromone flakes, which is basically to sort of suppress the population. It's not eradicating them. It's just sort of trying to hold them down further. But in the Ely example that you cited, Mr. Representative, that was an actual eradication, and we will check this spring to ensure that we were successful.
Representative Eklund?
No.
Okay. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had to get the picture of the gypsy moth there. Wanted to check, Mr. Friesa, back on Emerald Ash Borer. You said that there is not now, nor will ever be, any more Emerald Ash Borer funding from the federal government. Is that correct?
Mr. Friesa.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's correct. At one time, the funding at the national level was at about $40 million. I think it's probably about $5, $6 million. It's not expected that will be coming back. USDA APHIS has indicated they will be, and the remaining funds for EAB will be invested primarily for biological control and for some surveillance work.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, there's no money in the governor's budget for this, but there is, if we have the forecast and there's a supplemental budget, I would strongly encourage some money for this, because we're going to have a full-blown crisis here when the trees have to start coming down.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Friesel, you were at the committee either policy or finance a week or two ago, and we were talking a bit about the Palmer amaranth again. And as I recall, you said there was a 1% tolerance for amaranth seed in some of the grass mixtures coming into the state. Might it be wise to go to a zero tolerance on amaranth?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, just for clarification, and if a specific plant is not designated as prohibited, there's a general 1% tolerance for just sort of general weeds. So you can have the 1% of red root pigweed or any species. But in November of 2016, the commissioner designated Palmer amaranth as prohibited. So, and we are actually one of only two states that have prohibited Palmer amaranth in the seed mix. So, so currently there is a zero tolerance for Palmer amaranth in any seed mixes. And the challenge for us is distinguishing Palmer from other amaranth species.
Chair Anderson?
Just a quick follow-up, and not to beat this to death, but so are the seeds of the different varieties of amaranth similar? Do they look the same?
Mr. Friesa.
Mr. Chair Anderson, that's exactly correct. Typically, these are all very closely related species. The seeds look essentially the same. It's only by doing genetic testing on the seed or actually growing the plant out so that you can look at the whole plant itself.
Chair Anderson.
Thanks again. So I assume that however they clean this grass seed is light, and I don't know if like a fanning mill would work to clean grass seed, but how do you get the seed out of there if it in fact is in it?
Mr. Friesen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would have to get back to you. I'm not sure what the exact cleaning process is for seed. I will comment, though, my experience with seed is they are very good at cleaning up seed. Obviously, when you have a mixture, especially some of these native planting, where you have wide variety of seed sizes and shapes and everything, that's more challenging. But typically, when they do a blend, they'll clean, for example, black-eyed Susan in one patch and some other species in another batch, and then they just simply blend whatever the mix has been ordered by the farmer.
Chair Anderson? All right. Any other questions? Senator. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one. I can tell you that, the new weeds come in, and we always get really excited about them, but it seems like we don't stop too many. And I'm wondering if you believe that kind of the door is already open here. If this thing has gone wild in Iowa, how long can we really believe that we're going to be able to stop it? And is there anything that you're looking at in the future, if that's the case, anything you're looking at in the future to suppress it, deal with it, especially along our roads and in public lands?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I would agree. It is difficult to actually eradicate a weed once it comes into the state. I think we have a very unique situation in Minnesota. We have just 175 acres. I think there's a very different situation between Iowa and Minnesota. Minnesota has a very robust seed program and a very robust noxious weed program. So we do have a lot more strength. Iowa, I do not believe they have any staff whatsoever in the seed program, and they have a minimal noxious weed program. So I do think we are in a better position. Given that we know that there's just a limited number of sites, we are hoping that we will actually be able to eradicate this. That said, there's farm equipment moving across borders, and there is some possibility someday that this is going to move from Iowa into Minnesota, but in the interim, we think it's worth the investment to go after aggressively on the situation.
Representative Green.
I agree with you that I would like to aggressively go after it, but the wind doesn't stop at the border, and a good south wind can bring a lot of seeds in, and so it'd be nice to maybe think about what do we do, assuming that it does come flowing across, which I tend to believe it probably will one day.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree it is somewhat of a delaying action on our part, but that delaying action also gives us an opportunity to develop, to work with the university, to develop best management practices and to provide farmers with assistance on how to deal with this eventually. So I think in the short term we can have some success, but in the long term you're absolutely correct. There's going to be some you'll arrive here either on farm equipment or by critters or, who knows.
Yeah. All right. Representative Green? Okay. All right. We do have 35 minutes left, and I want to get everybody's questions answered. We're going to take time, and we're going to get through this. What we don't get to today, we'll roll over to next Tuesday. So next on the list is Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry. Mr. Friesel, you're not done.
Oh.
Give me my stuff back.
Director Friesel, I actually wanted to just talk about your last slide there, the top destinations for certified ag products, and to talk a little bit about trade and the concern. In Minnesota, we're a strong ag export state, and we need that. We fuel the economy here through agriculture in a lot of ways. So I'm just concerned about trade and what's happening in the federal system, and I'm just wondering if you would have any comments about, if 50% or nearly 50% are reflected or over 50% in what we have in front of us here, how you're handling what may be going on right now to impact our trade.
Ms. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, we are simply the sort of the certifying agency. As you can see from the slide, these Asian countries are huge markets for Minnesota. So our responsibility is simply to inspect the grain or the shipments and verify that they are to meet the standards set by Asian countries.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens when and if there is not an ability to export and you have an abundance here? I guess I'm not familiar with what your steps will be to kind of and maybe it's you don't have an answer to that, but I'm just trying to think ahead on what the potential issues are going to be.
Mr. Friesland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, again, if some Asian markets are blocked for whatever reason, you know, that's sort of the politics at a national level. Unless there's some alternate markets that are found, I would assume that grain would have to be either consumed domestically or stored until such time those markets open up again.
Representative Poppe. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. Some of the questions about worries about Palmer Amaranth or Emerald Ash Borer make me wonder the current attitude, I guess, at the federal level and others perhaps on getting rid of regulations. And the announcement that if one introduces a regulation, two have to be taken away. Does this cause you any anxiety to actually do your job if we're, you know, not taking a really careful look at regulations and making sure that we aren't removing something that might be really important? Not to say that we shouldn't review regulations. I think it's important that we do that for a variety of reasons. But I'm just wondering, does this cause you any anxiety, either in funding or in regulations?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, just yesterday, I was I'm an officer with the National Plant Board, and we had a conference call with leadership at APHIS PPQ. They are getting what he termed as guidance from the new administration, and that's so some of these things with regarding regulations and sort of putting a hold on things, those actually are somewhat typical when we see administrations change. I think there's just a lot of uncertainty and that's probably my biggest angst is we just don't really know yet how things will play out. I know we have a very good positive working relationship with USDA APHIS, and we will work directly with them to make sure that things like our phytosanitary inspections and other programs move forward as best they can.
Representative Bly. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Friesel, could you tell me what happened in Taiwan 2 years ago?
Mr. Friesel. Mr. Chair, Representative, I had that exact same question. So I did look that up before I came over here. For whatever reason, Taiwan made a very large purchase of soybeans from Minnesota. I don't know what the basis was, but that was a soybean purchase from Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Representative Barr, you okay?
All right. Seeing no other questions, Mr. Friesel, it's always a pleasure to have you testify in front of the committee here. Thank you. Ms. Blaze, who's up next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, next up we have Ben Miller. He's the director of our Food and Feed Safety Division.
Okay. Yeah. Welcome. And again, just a reminder, we have about 30 minutes. We are going to take time to get all our questions answered, we'll spill over into next Tuesday. So state your name for the record and begin, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ben Miller, Division Director for the Food and Feed Safety Division. And I just want to begin by thanking the support from this committee in the 2015 legislative session for the resources that they appropriated to the department. A lot of the work that I'm going to talk about today is a direct result of that support. And I would say that when we came at that time, we recognized the need for additional staff just for food inspection activity throughout the state, but those additional resources really came at a key time strategically as well. It allowed us to look at sort of how do we use those resources most efficiently and differentiate some of the work of our inspection staff. So you'll hear me talk about that. But just as way of background, if those that can remember, the Food Safety Modernization Act was passed in 2011, and that was really the biggest update to food safety law within the country for about 70 years. And a lot of the regulations that were promulgated because of the passage of that act are just now coming into effect. So they really affect areas like food manufacturing, animal food manufacturing, and produce safety. And those are some of the areas that I'll touch on today during my presentation. So just by way of the regulatory programs that are in our division, the Food and Feed Safety Division, we've got commercial feed inspection, manufactured food inspection, retail food inspection, and then we're just starting to look at the creation of a small produce safety program within the division as well. And so prior to the last time we've been in front of this committee, our food inspection staff did work for both manufactured and retail food. So we regulate, think of it, everything except restaurants, so grocery stores, convenience stores, food manufacturing facilities. And with the change in regulation, we recognize the need to both better serve public health, but also better serve the industry that we regulate as well. And so we differentiated that workforce into manufactured food and retail food. And with some of the new regulations that have come forth because of the Food Safety Modernization Act, that allows us to really have and develop expertise within our staff. So when they go into facilities and industries that we regulate, that they're conversant and very knowledgeable about the activities and practices that are going on in those facilities. You know, we want to be respectful of the food industry's time. We've got a really kind of a world-class food industry here in Minnesota, and a reputation that we've had for over a century. And so from a regulatory, state regulatory standpoint, we want to make sure that our workforce is in step with the workforce that we inspect and regulate. And so likewise, within the retail food arena, I think we've all probably seen a grocery store is very different today than it was even 10 years ago, and the kind of activities that are going on in grocery stores, we see actually kind of more food manufacturing activities occurring in those kinds of settings. So you've got complex and potentially high-risk processes going on in those facilities, like curing and smoking of meat and things like that. So again, we want to make sure that the workforce that we're sending in is well-educated and can provide good guidance and education. That's really where we start from our inspection standpoint, is we realize that we may only be in these facilities once a year. We want to make sure that we're in there and delivering good information as well as assessing the processes and practices that are going on in those facilities. So, as I've mentioned here, the purpose of the work, product safety and consumer and animal protection, as well as orderly commerce too. You know, we license all of the food facilities within the state, so manufactured food facilities. We do delegate our retail inspection authority to about 7 jurisdictions, primarily in the metro area, but we also license all of those retail food facilities as well. And so it's important that we're able to, as somebody contemplates starting a new business, that we're able to really react quickly, get out, assess what they want to do, inspect that facility, and make sure that they get their license as quickly as possible so that they can start doing what they want to do. Mm-hmm. Along those lines, and I'll mention it now, one of the things that we'll actually be debuting hopefully next week will be an online licensing system where if somebody's curious about starting a new business and wants information about what that looks like, they'll actually be able to go to our website and walk through kind of a TurboTax kind of interface, asking questions about what it is they intend to do to direct them to the proper license type that they will need. And we're excited about that because it will actually be in 4 languages. It's been translated into Spanish, Somali, and Hmong, as well as English, with some voiceovers too, so they get the audio in case, you know, there's issues with the reading of that. And so we're excited about that in terms of being able to direct folks the information they need in a timely manner. A little bit about our feed program. We inspect commercial feed in Minnesota, so that means feed that's distributed, sold and distributed in the state. So we inspect mills and distribution facilities as well as vehicles, and those inspections are based off of the risk or the kind of activities that are occurring at those feed processing facilities. A big part of that program is also product sampling and then record verification. We also monitor pet food, and we do a lot of label review for pet food that's sold within the state of Minnesota. So we look and make sure that the labeling on that product is correct and that the ingredients that are being used and sold, used in those products for sale are appropriate and fit for use. Our feed program also works closely with the FDA through contract inspections, so that's where the FDA designates a certain amount of their inspection work to the state and compensates us accordingly for that work. Our manufactured food program, so that's food processing. We license, as I mentioned, and inspect those facilities. Those inspections are also based off of the risk of the activity that's occurring in those facilities. Just as a way as an example, if you think of something like a food warehouse, that would be considered a low-risk facility because there's no real active handling of food in that kind of setting versus a processing facility where there's you might be making a ready-to-eat food product, and so the kind of controls and processes that need to be in place in those kind of facilities are significantly different, and so that's how we classify those facilities based on risk. Some examples of that would include beverage manufacturers, canneries, bakeries, food manufacturers, things like that. We do sample finished products occasionally. We have a robust environmental sampling program in those facilities when we partner with FDA when we conduct those activities. And that's something that's actually going to be a requirement for food manufacturing facilities as part of the Food Safety Modernization Act, is monitoring their production environment more actively through environmental monitoring. So the kinds of things that they would be looking for in those instances primarily would be Listeria species or Listeria monocytogenes or Salmonella are the two environmental pathogens that tend to be of highest concern in those settings. We also, like the Plant Protection Division, issue certificates of free sale for the export of products. So to export a product to many countries, they require that certificate from the department, and that's a reflection of the fact that that facility has been inspected within the past 6 months by the department and no significant violations have been identified. And so we issue those certificates that many products manufactured here can be exported internationally. And then, as I mentioned, we also inspect and regulate the food warehouses. We also, for manufactured food, conduct contract inspections with FDA, similar to the commercial feed program. Retail food, so this would include grocery stores and convenience stores and facilities along those lines. One of the primary things that we do is review construction plans for those facilities and make sure that construction of the food equipment going into those facilities is fit for use based on some national standards. And those kind of inspections and that sort of plan review activity that occurs is actually required before any business can open. So we actually do a pre-licensing inspection before any business is actually approved to operate. Again, we license and inspect those facilities. Again, those are based off of our inspection frequencies based off of the risk of the kind of things that are occurring within a food facility. So if you think about a grocery store that has a deli and a produce department and a seafood department and a meat department, because of the active food handling activities that are going on there, that may be a high-risk facility versus a food that's selling only, say, prepackaged food would be a low-risk facility. And again, I mentioned the delegated agencies that we work with closely, seven total cities and counties, primarily in the metro area, and so we work closely with those agencies in the oversight of their programs and a lot of education and outreach activities that we conduct as well. Some of the additional work that we do, as I mentioned before, FDA has been working closely with states to develop produce safety programs. As part of the Food Safety Modernization Act, that's really been a push from FDA to have the states have the primary inspection role in those arenas, and there's not all produce sold is actually covered under the produce safety rule. There's some sizable exemptions, but based on commodity type and the amount of product that's being sold, but those regulations will actually first come into effect January of next year. So the department's been partnering with FDA on looking at what that program might look like. For 27 years, we've had the Governor's Food Safety and Defense Task Force, which brings together the department, but also members of industry and academia to discuss relevant and timely food safety and food defense-related issues. And that's been a very productive and healthy relationship where a lot of good information and initiatives have started, and especially within the past several years when we've had to talk about the potential impact of new regulation associated with the Food Safety Modernization Act. That's been a wonderful forum where a lot of good information has been shared. We have a rapid response team, which is funded primarily through federal funds by the Food and Drug Administration. We were one of the first of six states to receive funding for that back in 2008. And that's really a reflection of our capacity to respond quickly and address foodborne illness-related outbreaks. You know, we've got a world-class health department that is able to identify when people get sick, but once that's been identified, our department and our division takes over and determines what may have made them sick in some instances. So the work that that group does is extremely important in terms of public health protection. We also oversee cottage food registration. We had an expansion in what could be sold and how what products could be sold and where they could be sold. Several years ago, termed cottage foods, and so we've stood up a registration system for that. And I think we have over 3,000 people registered under that registration system. So that gives us good insight into who's doing things, and it provides a good forum for education in terms of safe food handling practices, because this allows folks to sell product directly from their home, make and sell baked and canned goods directly from their home. And I know we've had a number of people that started in that registration system transition to a full food license, so that you saw that kind of progression from a home-based business to an actual licensable business, which is, I think, really the intent, or was one of the intents of that language. So, and then finally, we've got national regulatory program standards, which for us really fits hand in glove with a lot of the additional resources and that separation of workforce that we talked about between the manufactured and retail food inspection activities that we do. So FDA, in response to an OIG report that's now maybe about 10 or 15 years old, in terms of the FDA's oversight of state inspection programs, created program standards, which essentially define what it means to have a good regulatory program. And I'm excited to say that for our manufactured food program, we'll actually be audited by FDA in several weeks, and we hope to be the first state that's fully conformant in the most recent version of those standards, which I think is a good accomplishment. And by the end of June, we'll be one of the states will have four or five out of nine standards for our retail inspection program, which is the highest number that any state's been audited and verified in. So it's really about quality management for our regulatory programs, and that's really the key cornerstone of a lot of the work that we do. So what are some of the trends and challenges? Obviously, as the population of the state grows, the number of businesses that we license and inspect grow as well, which is a good thing. We've seen an expansion, certainly, especially in the retail food area over the last number of years. And we've also seen, as I mentioned before, a change in the kind of products that people make. I think Mr. Frizzo passed around some hemp product that was going to be manufactured and sold in Lunds and Byerly. So we're seeing a change in the kind of manufactured food products that are produced in the state as well as you know, just a shift in terms of the activities that are currently occurring in retail grocery settings. And that really reflects that an increase in complexity, and why we wanted to make sure that we've got a workforce that's able to really respond to some of those changes in the food industry. And, you know, we've got a change in the food product handling and consumption patterns as well. Fresh produce, farmers markets, food hubs, people's desire to access those kinds of products has obviously increased over the past several years. And so we also need to have a regulatory program that can adapt and change to those changes in consumer habits as well, so that we can ensure that there's food safety regardless of how and what people want to consume. And finally, Gary Horvath, our lab director, will be up next to talk about some of the work our laboratory does, but just changing technology, too, in terms of what we're able to detect related to foodborne illness outbreaks. It used to be, you know, my analogy would be, we could get to the fingerprint level, maybe, of the individual. Now we can get to the whole genetic code level of a particular organism that we might be investigating, so if that's E. coli or Salmonella or Listeria that might be associated with an outbreak. So our ability to detect and respond to outbreaks increases as the lab technology increases as well, which poses some opportunities but challenges as well. That's a brief overview of our division, from a funding standpoint, the majority of our funding comes from the general fund, so about $6.5 million. A certain portion, the 2,000 funds that you see there, about 10% comes from federal contracts that we have with FDA primarily, and the dedicated funds that you see there primarily fund our commercial feed inspection program. And then we have, within the 3,000 fund that you see listed there, federal grant dollars that we receive. So some of that goes back to those national program standards that I talked about, the rapid response work that we do, as well as the produce safety programs that we're taking on. So that's a brief overview of our division. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Any questions for the testifier? You did a thorough job.
Okay.
Thorough job. So, Ms. Place, we have, 13 minutes. What would you like to get started on?
I think we'll bring up Gary Horvath, and we'll get as far as we can with the lab services division.
So let's see if we can get through this, all right? 13 minutes. Ms. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Horvath. I'm the lab director at the Department of Agriculture.
Welcome.
And as you see on the slide, a robust lab producing high-quality results is the foundation of the, you heard the testimony of the regulatory division directors. Having that quality data to make decisions is the foundation of that work. So as part of our services, we provide the analytical services to these divisions. You can see them there. You heard testimony from Dr. Miller and Gear today and last week from the Pesticide Fertilizer Management Division and the Dairy and Meat Division. We also perform analysis for the DNR for eco-services and minerals. Got to be 15, 20 years ago, DNR closed their labs, and we took on that work, fish consumption advisories, mercury, PCBs, kills, and that type of thing. We also do work through the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division for the EPA for pesticide misuse and drift and enforcement and some groundwater work. And we also have various federal grants with USDA, FDA, especially the Food Emergency Response Network. So let's talk about the role of a regulatory lab a little more in enforcement and monitoring. We develop and implement methods specific to the agency. So, you know, Minnesota, the programs we have are like the pesticide use in Minnesota or specific issues that arise right now, like with Palmer, that type of thing. We provide, we can adapt and make methods for those programs, merging issues. We do routine work and support of their programs, and the main thing we do is provide legally and scientifically defensible data. And so to that end, we've focused a lot on improving our quality system. We were accredited in 2012 to the international standards. 17025 is like ISO 9000 you hear about. The 17025 is the laboratory standard for analytical testing labs. We were accredited in 2012. We continue to implement aspects of that, improve our quality system. We have a pretty robust continuous improvement system. We use root cause analysis and formal corrective action, so we're very much into producing high-quality data. So what does this do? Well, it instills confidence in the integrity of the data used in the decision-making. So our program managers for the various divisions have confidence in their data when they're taking action, be it regulatory or education. The regulated community has accurate information on which they're judged or responsibility is determined. It's their right and in our requirement to provide data so that the data being used in these decisions is accurate and true. And also the data is acceptable for use by the federal government and its partners. under FSMA and the Integrated Food Safety System. We've been working closely with FDA and being able to share data for decision making because of limited resources. You know, being able to accept another state's data is very important. So we're working on those elements also. So the scientifically and legally defensible data, the lab can provide high quality data that's fit for purpose in the state to address state issues and specific needs that a program may have. As you know, lab data is under more and more scrutiny legally, a lot more looking at the legal aspects, and so it's critical that we have those systems in place to meet that scrutiny and to, you know, produce the quality data that is expected of us. And again, data challenges that have come, we've been successful in defending our data, and so we put a great deal of effort into producing quality results. So just quickly, we contribute to Healthy Minnesota for food safety, as Dr. Miller talked about. We provide pathogen analysis. You can see them there, pesticide residues, toxins. We do species identification. Is it 100% ground beef, or is that got venison in it? You know, we can distinguish between species. We support the pasteurized milk ordinance, which is federal requirements for interstate shipment of milk for sanitary standards. We enforce that. Various compliance testing, and do some nutritional labeling verification. As I mentioned, we're a part of the Food Emergency Response Network. That is a USDA and FDA program looking at select agents in food matrices. Select agents are those agents that have been determined, be they biological or chemical, that could be used as a to attack the food supply and to poison people. We work with the FDA and USDA to validate methodology in various food matrices, and also we act as additional capacity in case something arises. We do use it a lot for national outbreaks with pathogens and chemical agents. You might have remembered a number of years ago we got involved. The firm was stood up to respond to melamine in milk protein, and we also got involved with the Horizon oil spill for seafood coming in. We developed a method for that, and then we used that to test in our state. So we also contribute to a clean and healthy environment. So we do monitoring, as I said, for the DNR and for our pesticide and fertilizer management division for inorganic nutrients resulting from manure and fertilizer application. We look for pesticides in water. This is mostly, environmental fate. We provide the data that allows the program managers to determine whether something's becoming a problem and maybe they need to institute pest management practices. So we do that. And we focus on, our methodology is very unique to Minnesota. We add compounds all the time, take them off, and so it's very robust and flexible. We are also the primary enforcement lab through working with PFMD and the EPA grant for spills, human exposure, animal exposure, variety of drift complaints. We are the primary lab responding to that. Also have the ability to do compositional chemistry of fertilizer, although that we haven't done a lot of that due to budget issues. We also, as I stated, are the DNR's lab. We do work to support their hatchery permits, nutrients and minerals and metal analysis. We're doing a lot of the heavy metal analysis from the northern Minnesota. That kind of went away when their management turned over, but now they're coming back to us slowly because of the quality I think we offer. We also do lakes and stream surveys for the limnological inorganic parameters that determine stream health. We do all that work, some pond studies. We get involved with incident response for them, chemical spills such as the Whitewater River, that type of thing. So we are their primary lab for that also. And finally, we contribute to a healthy ag economy through label verification of ingredients for seed, feed, and food. We get involved with issuing of final phytosanitary certificates with the Plant Protection Division and other. We do some limited plant pathogen testing. An overview, a quick overview of our budget. We have a budget of $9.3 million. A couple points I want to make here. Of that, $4.4 million is general fund, but then of that, $2.2 million goes to rent for our facility on Robert Street. The restricted miscellaneous, that's the FDA food inspections that the Dr. Miller's group does. We do the lab testing for that, and that's what that is. Then again, the ag fund is $2.96 million. And then our federal fund is 19% of the budget is $1.79 million. So that's real quick. I leave it open for questions.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Any questions, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I just hear you say that you're paying $2.2 million
yes.
for rent?
That is correct. Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Mr. Horvath, you're the right guy for me to be asking for this, but that's a state-owned building, I would gather, and everybody in that building is paying that sort of rent. Can you describe how that rent's paid? This is new to me.
Mr. Horvath, do you want to take that question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we receive that general appropriation, and we transfer it to the Department of Administration, and they maintain the building. They're responsible for all repairs, and that is the cost for lab space, is my understanding. Beyond that, you'd have to talk to the Department of Administration. That is in our lease, and that's what we pay, and that's what we get appropriated.
Thank you. Thank you. Now we have 2 minutes. Any other questions? Vice Chair Miller.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify off of Representative Johnson, so as you said, that's the cost of lab space, so that's not just the vanilla shell, that includes the, maybe not equipment, but the internal parts of the lab area, or what is that $2 million a year rent give you, besides light bulbs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is mostly for the building and the general exhaust, which is quite extensive in the building. It does not cover what is considered by the Department of Administration as program-specific equipment, which is quite extensive in the department. So a big chunk of our general fund, we have to be very careful because these systems fail, and we have to replace them. We're on the hook for, we have a HEPA filter system for microbiology lab, high purity water systems. We're on the hook for all of that, and that is something that is very difficult to manage. So we oftentimes have to hold money till late in the year, and then when it gets down, then we have the whole issue of our internal capital equipment, which we have a cash request in front of you. So it's pretty much the shell of the building, but in the general exhaust and plumbing and electrical, which is quite, you know, extensive for that building. But there are specialized pieces of equipment for which we have to pay.
Thank you, Mr. Horvath. We're going to call the meeting to an end. And we do wrestle with that rent question. We've done that for 10-plus years. So I think in this place, we'll ask in the next testifiers, we'll address that a little more, okay? And so we have the emergency ag account that we're going to carry over next Tuesday and then hear from the deputy commissioner, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. With that, we are adjourned.